for ex-Korean War POW, and he's now on trial for having sold out and gone over to the other side. And he's interrogated in his trial, and he's forced to admit that he had not been tortured. So his real crime was in succumbing to the mind control, and not just to the harsh conditions. So it's that betrayal, that brainwash storyline, you see, that seeps into the Vietnam era POW story. And I can say more of that.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, you know, when you were talking about that, I was thinking about when these first American pilots got shot down in the North, where there wasn't really any torture. They didn't get tortured. And that the only that they it seemed that they wanted to come home heroes, that they fought against this torture and this brainwashing and everything. Is that about right? Is that what?
That's spot on. Spot on.
Yeah.
Marv. Just a little bit more of what's interesting about those first pilots that were shot down. The first was Everett Alvarez,
right,
in 1964, on one of the first bombing missions after the Gulf of Tonkin incident,
mm-hmm.
And he was captured. He came down over Ha Long Bay, that many Americans will know today as a very attractive tourist site.
It is beautiful.
But the Vietnamese didn't know what to do with Alvarez. He was captured by civilian Vietnamese fishermen, if I remember right.
Right.
And then eventually turned over to the police or military authorities, and he was taken to Hanoi. They didn't know what to do with him, so they put him in the city jail. The Hanoi city jail,
yeah,
was Hoa Lo prison.
Right. No French prison.
A French prison. A prison that the French had built.
Right.
And that became then later namesaked, or not namesaked, but what's the word I want? Name-tagged the Hanoi Hilton.
Right.
But they ended up there not because it was a POW prison, city. And I love this part of that story that since he was not in the budget.
Yeah, he wasn't in the budget. That's right.
For food, they ordered out.
Yeah.
For food.
Yeah. They went to restaurants.
Local restaurants.
Yeah.
Bring in food for him and maybe the first other prisoners who were brought into Hoa Lo. Marvin, I've lost track of the question that set me off on this. What is it that you had?
Oh, asked? I was when they first, like when they the pilots, the
oh yeah,
early pilots that came down, they wanted to be heroes. They did, you know, they didn't want to be thought of like the Korean POWs were.
Exactly.
They wanted to be thought of as resistors of He-Man. But they weren't.
Exactly. And so what we think, and you're right, in the first, certainly the first year, maybe beyond the first year, not even those first pilots who were shot down claimed to have been tortured.
Right.
Alvarez was very committed to not giving his interrogators any militarily sensitive information. You know, the code is name, rank, and serial number.
Right.
That's all that you say. You don't answer any more questions. And within a day or two, his interrogators were feeding him information about his civilian life and about his aircraft and other stuff that just amazed him. And so his thought began to become, my God, if they know all of this, what don't they know?
Right.
And what point is there in me, holding out? And so I don't know, I don't remember, then at what point in his particular story that his behavior did change. My co-author, Tom Wilbur, by the way, did interview Everett Alvarez.
Really?
Talked to Everett Alvarez more than once by telephone in the course of working on our book. But then, you're absolutely right, that others of the POWs, more senior pilots who were shot down, we think. There's another important author, Craig Howes is his name, and he wrote a book called Voices of the Vietnam POWs. And he says that he concludes that these senior POW pilot officers concocted this hero POW narrative, and while the treatment of the pilots may have been rough, quite rough, that it's a judgment call whether torture is the right word.
Right.
But that these senior pilots, kind of concocted much of the torture story. So that when later pilots were shot down, they were taught, Craig Howes says, this curriculum about how rough it was in these first few years, after the first couple of years, then how rough it became for the pilots who were shot down. And what Tom and I kind of became aware of, and I think maybe our words were the first ones that used this, that none of these torture stories are collaborated.
Right.
There are no witnesses. The Vietnamese people who were in charge of Hoa Lo prison, who interrogated the U.S. POWs, all deny that there was any torture. Now, you can dismiss those claims and say, well, it's in their self-interest, to say that. But there have been North Vietnamese veterans of the war, former prison employees, plenty of Vietnamese who are not happy with the course of Vietnamese history after the war. Plenty of people who could have, and you would expect, would have spoken out by this time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If there was torture, they would have said, they would be willing to say, yes, these U.S. POWs who claim to have been tortured, yes, they're telling the truth. As far as we know, Tom and I know, there are no such claims about this.
Yeah.
So we think that the claims of torture are pretty sketchy.
Right.
And open to interpretation.
Right.
The other interpretation being that this harsh treatment was punishment. I mean, the stories that these POWs tell in their own memoirs, when I read these, my God, if you did this in a U.S. prison, torture would hardly cover it. You know, you I don't know. I mean, your guards would beat the living tar out of you.
Yeah.
For some of these things that these U.S. POWs admit to having done in their own memoirs. And so those are some of the things about this that Tom and I write in our book.
Yeah. One of the things in your book, too, that I thought was really interesting, I don't know. Things changed when Stockwell got there. Because he tried to be the boss of all these downed pilots. He wanted to be the boss and tell them what to do and everything. But who was he, the officer that was afraid that he beat himself up?
Oh, my.
Yeah, tell that. That's really interesting.
You know, if you hadn't just reminded me of that, I might not have remembered that already. Actually,
yeah.
Stockdale was one of those, and there's another whose name I'm not gonna think of. You're right. They actually, yes, they beat themselves up. They damaged themselves such that they would be able to claim when they came home that their injuries were caused by their guards. And now, your listeners might say, well, I'm making this up. No.
No.
They say this in their own memoirs.
Right.
One of these fellows, and I better not use the name because I might have the name wrong, but tells a kind of... He adopts a kind of Christ persona for himself, that he for example, he swallows lie.
Oh, right.
To make it so that he can't talk, and he threatens to do all kinds of. What we get out of his memoir is, in some part, the story that he tells about what he imagines doing to himself.
Right.
Out of penance is really the word that I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm.
That he wants to prove to himself that he is worthy. It's real. It's stuff that somebody else should write a book.
Right. Because that was so interesting, Jerry,
yeah.
Because he would beat himself in the throat.
Yes.
He made the lie to swallow out of his soap. He didn't want to talk on the camp system.
Yeah.
Where everybody could hear.
Right.
And he didn't want to do that. Stockdale didn't want... He wanted to be in front of the cameras if somebody came, where he could say, you know, look how beat up I am. And in your book, you also say that the reason that some of those... Oh, we lost him. Yeah, he's going to call him back. Okay, what Jerry's talking about is that over the camp broadcasting system, that all of these hardcore guys that came back and they all broke down and they all talked. They all wrote letters against the war. They all talked, and when as soon as we get Jerry back, I want to ask him about when the POWs from the South came up north, which is Bob Chenoweth, Arrieta, Young, King, and I can't remember the other guys. I'm sorry, but how things changed when these guys, they were all, well, they weren't pilots. They were all grunts. They were all soldiers on the ground in the South. And Jerry will be able to talk more about that. But one of them was my friend Bob Chenoweth, who we interviewed, what, maybe 10, 15 years ago. He did a two-hour interview with us. But these other guys, these educated pilots, you know, trained and all this stuff, they broke the rules. They did everything so that they would be brought before the commander of the guard, and they would be punished for breaking the rules. And that's what happened. And then they came home and they said we were tortured. Like Jerry said, there was nobody saw it. They didn't want to be compared to what happened to the pilots in the Korean War. They did not want to be. They wanted to come home. When they did come home in 1973, the first ones that the news talked to, the first ones that they did TV interviews with, were the pilots. The pilots. That's who they talked to, was the pilots. And they all made up the stuff that they were all these brave guys and everything. But they all talked. They all talked. And they just had to make themselves seem to be, you know, heroes. And they weren't. They weren't. They were no different than the guys that were prisoners that were brought up from the South. They were brought up from the South. In fact, one of the guys that they talk about in the book is George Smith, who was captured, I think, in 1964, 1965 in the South. And he was a POW in the South for 2 years before they let him go. And he wrote a book, POW, My 2 Years with the Viet Cong. And I believe that he's still alive. I believe George is still alive. And he wrote a book about, you know, how they thought, how the Viet Cong thought and all this. But the longest held POW of the Vietnam War was not Alvarez, the pilot. It was a special forces guy in the South. He was the longest held POW was in the South. And I think he came out in 1973 also. He had a really hard time after he came home. He had a really, really hard time. That's another thing that I wish we had more time with Jerry, because they tried to make these guys, these pilots, these guys that were captured in the South, to make the Americans think that they had mental problems, that they came home with mental problems. That's why they couldn't resist what happened to them in the prisons in the North, the prison camps in the North. And that's what they were, Jerry had a really, really good. Jerry, are you there now? Okay, thanks. Oh, he ran out of battery. Okay, so I'll go ahead and talk about it. Yeah, Bob Chenoweth talked a lot. He's from Portland, actually. He's from Portland, but now he lives up in Moscow, Idaho. But he talks a lot about that, about how they were treated by these older pilots, how they tried to make them be what they were, you know, to fall in line and do the company line and don't talk about anything and all this when they already did. And Bob said that they were threatened with things like, boy, when we get back, okay, Jerry, are you ready?
Yeah, I'm back. I'm really sorry about
that. That's okay. Hey, talk about when the guys that were captured in the South were brought to Hanoi. In 71, when they spent those 2 years before they left out, they were at Wallow Prison. Talk about the Peace Committee.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that's such an important part of the story.
That is really important.
Yeah. Because part of what we, Tom and I, develop in this book is that there was a real class and race divide.
I forgot that.
Yeah, between the pilots who were shot down and the people from the South, the GIs who were captured in the South and then brought north to Wallow Prison. Now, there were some of the pilots who were shot down, like Gene Wilbur and Ed Miller, who were from very modest class backgrounds.
Right.
Rural, working class. Ed Miller was had grown up in an orphanage, if I recall correctly.
I think you're right.
But most of the pilots were college educated, of course. Many of them graduates of the Air Force Academy or the Naval Academy at Annapolis. Some of them had master's degrees. All right. The people who were captured in the South were almost all working class. Of the eight who became known as the Peace Committee, I think two of the eight were white Caucasians.
Right.
The others were not white, not Anglo.
Right.
And the sociology in our book, the sociology of this story, is that the guys coming out of the South, the guys captured in the South, had more empathy, more identification with the Vietnamese, the poverty of the Vietnamese peasants, the people who had captured them, than did these more upper class or upper middle class pilots who were shot down in the North. Guys coming out of the South had some contact with the Vietnamese before they were captured.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnamese worked in our camps in the South.
Mm-hmm.
They were service workers for us. I've made quite good friends with a couple of Vietnamese who worked in a camp where I was. The pilots, on the other hand, had never seen a Vietnamese.
Yeah, they never
before they were captured.
Yeah, they never spent any time with the Vietnamese.
Right.
They
were shot. They flew off U.S. aircraft carriers.
Right.
They flew out of Thailand. There were some exceptions. There were some air bases in Vietnam, in South Vietnam, and those pilots may have had some contact with Vietnamese civilians before they were shot down. But our analysis then is that because the people coming out of the South, the enlisted men, the draftees who came north, they were more inclined to a critical view of the war. I mean, some of them had thoughts of, what the heck am I doing here?
Right.
These are people like my family.
Right.
These are people like I grew up with.
Exactly.
What in the heck am I doing here trying to hurt these people?
Exactly.
And so when they got to Hanoi and they were in the prison and they had a lot of time to think about it, they really began to change their minds.
Mm-hmm.
And so when when Western journalists came to talk to them, they were more willing to speak critically about the war.
Right.
And when U.S. anti-war activists came to visit, they were more inclined to say, yeah, I'll talk to Tom Hayden. Yep, I'll talk to Jane Fonda. Sure. And so that's our analysis.
Yeah, Clay, you know, that, I hadn't thought about that because I was one of those poor kids, you know, poor kids. And I'd never really thought about that class part of it. I think maybe I talked to Chenoweth about it a little bit. I'm not sure, but I know that, yeah, there really was a really distinction about, they thought that those officers always thought they were better than us guys.
Oh, absolutely.
They thought they were better. They knew more.
Oh, yeah.
You know, than we did.
Yeah.
And they could boss us around. But that didn't, towards the end of the war, that kind of got a line got crossed there, didn't it?
Sure.
Towards the end
of
the war.
Well, the other thing.
Go ahead.
Another thing that played into this is a kind of nuance, right, in what you and I have said so far, is that after the Tet Offensive in 1968,
nasty,
the U.S. government then, well, Westmoreland wanted more troops in Vietnam because we weren't winning the war yet.
Nope.
And, in order to get those troops, the draft system had to get people who had been deferred for college and deferred for occupational reasons. And they got people like me.
Yeah, they got you, didn't
who
they?
who had been to college.
Yeah.
And we weren't from those upper middle class or upper class backgrounds, but we were educated, and we had a little bit of exposure to the anti-war movement by that time, by virtue of having been on college campuses, and we were not real amenable to military discipline and to the authoritarianism.
Yeah, because it is authoritarian.
Oh, yeah.
It is really authoritarian.
And so we became kind of, I don't know, maybe kind of the leading edge of the GI resistance movement.
Yeah.
In Vietnam. And I'm kind of getting to another part of your point here. We were really resented by the officers. Particularly the lower grade officers, the lieutenants, the captains.
Yeah, captains, first and second lieutenants.
Who they, you know, they were undergraduates, at least they graduated. And so we were sort of peer group challenges to them.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't so easily dismissed as weak personalities, we weren't so easily dismissed as having been duped by campus radicals.
Mm.
You see,
mm-hmm.
We had to be taken more seriously as people who had figured this out on our own.
Right.
That this war is wrong. And I think, you know, to go back to the POWs, you see, the officers who came out against the war were not so easily dismissed as men of weak character.
Right.
The senior ranking officers, like Stockdale, they tried to run that number on them and on the public,
mm-hmm.
about them, but that wasn't so easy. It wasn't so easy to dismiss these people. So yeah, all of this stuff is really class laden.
Class laden, exactly.
You really can't understand a lot of this without a class analysis.
Right, that's
of what's
true.
Going on.
When I get home today, I'm going to really think about that. Because I didn't like the officers at all,
uh-huh.
you know.
Oh,
at all. I didn't like officers, yeah. you know, because I didn't like them.
Yeah. My analysis. I wrote an article about this, by the way.
No,
that the origins of the GI movement lie not so much in pacifism,
mm-hmm.
or political opposition to U.S. imperialism or colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
The origins of it lie in the animosity toward officers. It's rejection of military authority and rejection of the authoritarianism. That's what set off our generation of GIs, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And that opened us up to more political interpretations.
I think you're right.
Of what's, that opened us up, you see.
Yeah.
And my first resistance, me as a resistance, as a resistor within the military, was simply to the military. And it was later, you know, by the time I came home, maybe, but then after I came home, when I got involved in the anti-war movement, that's when I really began to deepen my political understanding.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Me too. I couldn't see where it was any of our business, Jerry, to be in Vietnam. I couldn't see it was any of our business to be in Vietnam. And
right.
just like you were saying, you know, those people are just like us. And I've talked to a lot of North Vietnamese soldiers, old soldiers, and Viet Cong soldiers, both men and women, and they were just like us.
Uh-huh.
They were just like us, and they wanted us out of their country.
Yeah.
Jerry, we've run out of time, buddy. We ran out of time. I wish we had more time. But yeah, I'm gonna read your article about that class.
Yeah, I can give that to you. I'll send you.
Yeah, send it to me, okay?
You bet.
Jerry, I want to thank you for doing this for me. I really appreciate it, and you've written some really, really good books. I'm telling you.
thanks for your contact.
And you've given me a lot to think about.
All right.
Okay, Jerry. I'll talk to you later. Send me that stuff, okay, buddy?
Will do.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Bye, bud.
Bye-bye.
That was really interesting, especially when he brought up the class divide. You know, I probably knew it. I just didn't think about it. I want to say hi to my friends in Nebraska, Gary and Darla. I want to say hi to Kathy. I want to say hi to Mitty and the grandchildren, her grandchildren. I want to say hello to Joe Lewis, who was at Kent State and was shot by the Ohio National Guard in 1970. I want to say hi to my good buddy Jim, who's been a good friend. And we'll be back May 17th at 9 a.m. And there it is. Thank all of you.
tattoo, and he's 6 feet four. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31, and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Lobau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the
You're
one
listening
who
to KBOO
Portland,
9.7 FM.
Of the war. And
the time is
him,
10 a.m.
Can't go on.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
You're invited to tune into KBOO's Blues Junction Saturday evening, April